Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Right, we've Peter Kellett on the line. And Peter, you're very welcome. You work in the baking industry and we've been talking about the cost of living. Well, we've been talking about it for years, but we're talking about it again now because anybody who goes to the supermarket or gets their electricity bill or whatever it is, they just, the bills seem to be going up and up and up. And you really see it in your own industry.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks very much for having me on, Sarah. I appreciate it. Yeah, I suppose what everybody's looking at is the cost in the supermarket. But what we need to do is look in the background and see where it's all coming from. And what I'm seeing is that, you know, from the Ukraine war, we had a global wheat price increase of 28%. And everybody was panicking then because of the war. Where were we all going to get our wheat from to produce our breads?
Okay.
And what happened then is that from there on, we were able to come to an agreement with Russia to allow the wheat to come out. So we eventually got the wheat out. But the prices were still inflated. And because the war was on continuously ongoing, we had other European countries then producing the wheat. And what happened then was there was a huge demand for fertilization to grow the wheat, and fertilizers increased. And there's all these knock-on effects that has happened. And prices have come back slightly, but not to the level that they went up. You
okay.
know, like we've,
so
we've
that's
had.
One aspect of your industry, obviously, wheat, and it's a really important
yes.
aspect of the baking industry. And actually, just on that, I was speaking to someone recently who said that's why Weetabix, if you've noticed, the cost of Weetabix has gone up. That's actually related to that issue as well that you're talking about, the war in Ukraine. So you have wheat, you also have butter. And
yes.
this is something that we all feel when we're getting our pound of butter in the supermarket. It's increased, actually, by €1.08. It's up to €4.87. I mean, it's really expensive now, but that really affects you.
Yes, well, it does affect us because we use a lot of butter in the bakery industry, and then we use byproducts from butter like margarines and shortenings and stuff like that. And they all have the same knock-on effect. But it's the same thing. Like the background to that then is like from 23 to 24, the amount of cattle that has been reduced by 1.2% in this country, which is 22,000 heads, according to Board Beer. So there's been less production going on. And the reason behind that is the uncertainty around the nitrate derogation, which is affecting the milk production. So,
wow.
And then
so
you have the global
so
markets.
So interesting. So the nitrates
yeah.
derogation, obviously, that's all related to climate and this
yes.
pressure on Ireland in particular in relation to the nitrates derogation to do better on that. So you're saying as a result
Correct.
Of that, the number of cattle has gone down, and that's leading then to an increase in the price of dairy products.
Correct, yes. Because we actually grew our dairy cattle by 328,000 between 2015 and 2024. And what's happened then is since 2023-24, we started reducing because of what was going on. And that's been reduced. Like last year alone, there were 50,000 heads of cattle were dropped on the dairy production.
Okay.
So then you have the global markets. We export an awful lot of dairy products as well. And you can see the carry-on of America with regard to the tariffs and what
yeah.
have you.
Yeah.
So we don't know. It's the not knowing is the biggest issue of everything in food production.
Yeah, well, we hear
and,
this with all businesses, don't we?
Because they put
uncertainty.
These tariffs on this now, we don't know how much production we're going to be able to export going forward.
Okay.
So we're all trying to control that so we don't have mountains of milk.
Okay, okay.
And that's where that is.
Because milk has also gone up, isn't it? Milk has gone up
well.
28 cents, just for people who are like, cause in case people think they're imagining it, they're not imagining it. The prices
yes.
are actually going. Now, some prices are coming down, but for the most part, the staples that you need, like the milk and the butter and the bread and the cheese, like cheese is up 70
yes.
cents and the milk is up 28 cents. Bread is up 5 cents, which doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, it all starts to add up then, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely, yeah. And that's just on your run-of-the-mill sliced pan. But then as you go further into the likes of sourdoughs where you need speciality flours, they're even more expensive. And then you go into sweetened products that need butter and sugar and all the extras, you're adding in their costs as well. So it's all a knock-on effect.
Okay, so when I go into the supermarket, because I have noticed at the odd time at the weekend, I treat myself to one of those speciality breads that you're talking about in my local supermarket, because they have some really lovely breads. Yeah. That are baked fresh on site, but they're expensive in comparison to a sliced pan. And I have noticed they've got smaller and they're more expensive. But you're saying that's not the supermarket gouging, because we're told this week supermarkets aren't gouging. That's because all those input costs that you're talking about have gone up.
Absolutely. And the biggest one of all is labour. Mm-hmm. Because, again, because of, since the Ukraine war, if we go back to that again, the population has skyrocketed in this country. So that's put huge demand on housing, energy, clothing, food, and we created full-time because of that demand.
Okay. Do you have any idea, Peter, where you start to fix this with the cost of living generally for people? Like, because it sounds to me like, for example, what you're talking about in the dairy industry there, if we want to tackle the climate issue, which we do need to tackle, apparently yes. Bring down the herd is one of the issues that we need to look at. So then does that just mean we have to accept higher prices in some industries?
I think we're going to have to going forward. Now, what they're trying to do in the dairy industry is make it more efficient so that we get better volume out of the, if you like, more milk out of the cow,
Yeah.
And that's where we're going to have to go down that road. And, because of the export market being reduced as well, which I think it will be with these tariffs, but we'll have to see where that goes. But how do we start to fix this? The tax man.
And what do you mean by that? You need to cut taxes.
Go on. We've created full employment, which means there's more employees, there's more PAYE going into the system, there's more purchases because there's more people purchasing, so there's more VAT, and there's a bigger demand, so there's more corporate tax. So it's a win-win-win for the government.
So you're saying to cut VAT?
Well, I think they need to, I'm not saying necessarily to cut the VAT. I don't want to get into that specific field, but I'm just saying that the government needs to do something. Like, if you take, for instance, like they're saying now that a beer has gone from €5 to €6.
Yeah.
So the VAT on beer at €5 was 60 cents. If it goes up to €6, the VAT is then 72 cents.
Okay,
so automatically the government gets a 20% increase.
Although, we've had that whole debate in the restaurant industry, haven't we? And yet we see today restaurant and hotel prices have jumped 2.7%, for the consumer. When you look at some of the figures. Eggs is another big one, isn't it, Peter?
Eggs is a huge one, yes.
So what's going on there?
Well, we've had avian flu in Europe and an awful lot of egg-producing countries in the whole of Europe. Now, we've only had one batch of it here, as far as I'm aware. But that's still created a big demand for our egg. And that's, again, that's had a huge price increase.
Okay.
And it's come back slightly, but again, it's probably increased by 20%, and it's come back by maybe 6 or 7%.
Okay.
So it's kind of staying up, and this is what everything seems to be doing at the moment, I don't think there's price gouging going on.
Yeah, well, apparently there isn't. There's been an investigation, and it's saying there isn't.
Yes.
I just want to ask you before I let you go about steak, because I know some restaurants have stopped offering steak because they say they can't ask the price that it would cost to serve it. And you've had that experience. You've been in a restaurant. What did you see a steak in a restaurant for?
Well, I was explaining that to your researcher earlier on, and I went out for a meal recently, and I had noticed that there was a fillet steak, which was the dearest thing on the menu, to be fair.
Yeah.
And it was €58.
And was that for one or two people?
I couldn't believe it.
One person? It wasn't like...
That was for one person, €58, yes.
Wow, okay,
Now, that restaurant was quite quiet when I went in, but by the time I left it, because I was on an early bird, and when I left it, it was packed.
Okay. Well, some people are able to pay. You see, this is the thing. They might not like it, but they're able to pay it. Peter, thank you so much. 500-51 if you want to get in touch on that, or 0818-715-815 if you want to call the programme today. I want to talk to Louise Crowley now, who is a dairy farmer, as it happens, but we're not talking about dairy prices right now, Louise. We want to talk about trespassing and the issues that farmers are having with trespassing. Can you tell me your own story?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Look, I suppose I'm one of the many farmers around the country that has to put up with and deal with trespassing on our private property, on our farms. I would have a lot of cases of trespassers coming in, but I suppose the worst case I had was when a group of five men with several dogs that were all loose came into the farm. I didn't realise that they were in until my own dog took off down the roadway after them, and, you know, barking at their dogs. Okay. And when I walked down to see what was happening, they had come in. Basically, I asked them politely to leave.
Sorry, Louise, I'm just going to stop you for a second because I just want to get a picture in my head, first of all, as to what sort of land we're dealing with here. Can you tell me a little bit about the farm and you know, what sort of land you have and fences and all that? Just describe it for me.
Yeah, so we're a dairy farm here, so all our fences would be in very good order. We have only maybe two or three boundaries that would have other farmers outside of us. So we're very enclosed, so anybody that comes into us actually comes in through another farmer's land to get into us.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's just the two of us that are farming here.
Yourself and your dad.
You know, yeah, myself and my dad. And
have you been at it long?
I'd be farming all my life. I grew up on the farm, you know, giving a hand, but I would be full-time farming, I suppose, for the last 10 years.
Okay. And in terms of people coming on the land then, you're saying they walk through other farmers' land generally because of the way you're situated. But would that happen often? Would you often have people walking through, or, you know, walkers out for a walk?
You would. Look, there's lots of genuine people that come in, but they ring and give you the heads up that they want to come in. But it's those that they come in specifically Saturdays and Sundays, early in the morning or late in the evenings, you know, kind of peak times where they don't think you'll be around. Unfortunately, where we're situated, we're only less than 2 minutes off of the Limerick-Cork Road. So it's very easy for these people to be dropped off in cars and collected then as soon as they know they're spotted, or a farmer, or in my case, you know, I went down and politely asked them, can you please leave? This is private property. They laughed at me. I was called names. You know, they threatened that they would cut our wires, burn down the farm. That one said that they would break my neck. And it was put to me, like, who did I think I was to be asking them to leave? And if you saw where they actually did leave eventually, it was the hole in the hedge wasn't big enough for the dog to willingly want to go through it. They had to pull them, you know, kicking and screaming through it. So, like, there is no access points for them to freely come in and out.
Okay.
But they still manage it.
That must have been really scary. So you're talking about, you're on your own, are you? You were on your own when this happened?
I was. So unfortunately, most times you see if they come in the weekends, they know it's going to be probably minimal people around the farm.
Okay.
And it happened that, yeah, I was there on my own. So,
and it's
look,
you on
I'm
your own with four men and five dogs. And were you worried about approaching them?
Well, I kept a certain amount of distance between us because, yeah, I would be afraid. It would be very easy to, you know, overcome me on my own.
Mm.
But I'm now at the point where I just can't take the chance to confront any of them anymore. I was too, I suppose, frightened and shook, I suppose, in that altercation. But even from, you know, speaking with the guards, and they've been very helpful to me in any situation, but they are very fearful that something could happen to me. So anytime now I see them, it's basically maybe drive past in the tractor or go up onto the higher ground so they know that they're being watched and seen. And I ring the guards, but I just can't take the chance, because if something happens to me, I don't know to what extent I could get injured, or I'm going to be out of work, or it's really a terrible place to be frightened in your own property.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. And I know as well, like, you have obviously cows, 200 cows, I think, on the land. Mm. And even in an instance where the dogs might not attack the cows or the animals, it can be very stressful for the animals.
It can be. Like, if loose dogs come in around a herd of cows or any group of animals, it can stress them out. Especially if you're, I suppose, in times of breeding season, it can impact, you know, the results you're going to get, I suppose, for the coming years, or if your cows were due to calve. But it's a health implications. You don't know where these people have been, where these dogs have been in other farms. Mm. You know, TB is a huge issue around the country. It could be carried in and out from one farm to the other. You know, there's lots of diseases that pass from other animals and stuff, and like, we do our best to keep our boundaries secure and do everything right, and have biosecurity measures, and then these people come in and you just don't know where they've been.
Okay, or how they're going to react, as you found, if you ask them to leave. Yeah, okay. So what you're looking for then, and I know other farmers are looking for something like this too, is that the burden of proof of trespassing is taken off the farmer. That basically, that if you're found to be trespassing on farmer's land, you have to prove that you got permission. That's the way it would work in future. Is that right?
Yeah, so really, currently, all the onus is put on me as a landowner and a farmer to prove that I didn't want these people in there, that they hadn't permission. And it's very unfair. I think if you look at the setup, like, if someone walked into my house, I wouldn't have to prove that I didn't want them there. You know, it would be taken, your house is private property, why did you go in there? Mm. You know, but that attitude isn't there for landowners and farmers. So, yeah, I think it would go an awful long way to alleviate the stress that farmers are dealing with if you could say, well, prove who gave you permission. Why are you entitled to be in here? Because there is very few people, you know, that aren't genuine, that will have this, you know, an excuse to come in.
And is there, because I do wonder, you know, you do have walkers who might be out in the country and not realise they're walking on farmer's land. You know, could that happen? Would that happen? And what about then, you know, they'd have to prove that they got permission. They didn't realise they needed to get permission.
Well, I think if you're walking in an area and you're from the area, you're going to know the landowners. You know, I have lots of neighbours that would say to me, you know, can we come in and walk up the hill? Or when the snow in the spring, you know, they rang and said, you know, can we go up? And there's no problem that way at all. But farms are, boundaries are so secure nowadays. You know if you're going from one farm to the other, because it's not going to be easy to actually do it. You know, if you're going through an actual set gap or a gate, then you know you're probably still in the same block of land. But like, if you have to actually if it's a challenge to get through a ditch into another field,
yeah, you're on someone else's land.
You have a fair idea. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. It's a really interesting point. Interested to hear from listeners on this. 087-484-8888 is the WhatsApp number if you want to get in touch. Louise Crowley, thank you very much.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Barry Teague, good afternoon. You're very welcome to the programme.
How's it going?
Not too bad at all. Listen, thank you so much for joining us, because you have the most interesting story, and an unusual story, I think, for an awful lot of people. You're a big champion dancer, Irish dancer, but it's the story really of how you got there and the journey along the way that I want to hear about. Can you tell me, how did you get into it?
Well, my sister had started dancing when she was very young, probably since she could walk, you know. So I kind of just started to go into the classes with her and whatever. And then I think I danced until maybe 4 or 5, and then I quit again until I was 7. And then from 7 on, I just never stopped.
Okay, so you really... And did you realise at 7 or 8 that you were good at it and that you really liked it?
I mean, I'd won a few things probably when I was younger, but no, not really. I think I was just doing for like the fun of it, you know, like in a way.
Okay. And when did you start to take it seriously then? So 7 or 8, you start to go to feshes and, you know, you're doing fairly well. But I'm sure you had loads of other things on as a 7 or 8 year old in your life.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, I was playing football and all at the same time. So it definitely wasn't the main priority when I was younger. There was just a lot of things. But I'd say I probably started taking dancing seriously maybe around 13, 14. I really just like started to try and get into it.
Okay, and when you say taking it seriously, I think people involved in Irish dancing will probably relate to this. It really is a big commitment, isn't it? You're at it 5, 6 days a week?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so definitely 5 days, 6 days a week, definitely.
So can you give me an example of your day then as a 13-year-old? What did that look like with school, with dancing and whatever else you're doing? You were doing football as well.
Yeah, so I probably get up, whatever, and then go to school in the mornings, and then probably had school football right after school. So we'd all walk out there to football, and then either my mum or my dad, whoever could lift me that day, would lift me from the school training. And then dancing was close to the football field, so I would just get changed in the car and then go to dancing, and go to dancing for a few hours, and then come home, do my homework, and then go to bed.
Were you wrecked?
Yeah, it was hard going there.
Okay, but you were determined, obviously, and things were going very well. And then what happened when you were 14?
Yeah, so then whenever I was 14, after probably about a year of doing that there schedule, I started to get like a bad pain around my back, like the lower back area. And then after months and months of acupuncture sessions and I don't know how many different physios my dad had to take me to, but then finally we got in for an MRI scan, and then the MRI scan had shown 2 prolapsed discs and then a few spinal fractures.
So literally you'd sort of broken your back?
Yeah, pretty much. I'd broken my lower lumbar back, they said, yeah.
And was that from overtraining, just your body wasn't able for it, or did they know what happened?
Yeah. And pretty much they said that it was just too much stress on the back, yeah, from just overdoing it. And the amount of time I think I was doing it just took its toll.
Okay. So what did they do then with you to look after you? What did you have to get? Was there surgery or was it medication? What happened?
So I went up to the Musgrave Park Hospital in Belfast and they had me fitted for a back brace. So that there took about a few weeks to get ready. And then my parents took me up to Belfast for any appointments I had to go to, you know. So wore that back brace for about a year. And then after the year, there was just like a lot of rehab, you know, physios and more hospital appointments and personal trainers and just everything really, yeah, to get me back into the shape after the back brace.
God, that's an awful lot for a 14-year-old, isn't it? Is the back brace, is that sort of like a cast? I mean, how much movement did you have when you were in it? And was it on you all the time?
So, yeah, you'd get up in the morning and you would, it's like, I don't know how you describe it. It's kind of like a hard plastic shell, kind of.
Okay.
And you had to Velcro it around your, basically your whole upper body, you know. And no, there wasn't really much movement on it. You put it on when you got up in the morning and then you didn't take it off until you went to bed at night.
Okay, so there was no physical activity for you then during that whole year, was there?
Oh yeah, no, definitely nothing. Yeah. Like the most I'd done was walk around school probably.
How'd you find that?
Yeah, it's not easy, like going from being so active and having so many things going on to just all you're doing then is schoolwork, you know, it's not great.
And how did you find it just from a social perspective, like being in class and stuff like that? How did your friends react? You know, how was your sort of life outside of school?
Yeah, again, like it wasn't, even I could go to the football matches and watch and support or like go to the dancing and maybe like help out the odd time with the wee ones, you know, the younger ones. It's just not the same, you know, you're not really involved in anything.
Okay. So you had that year, which was very difficult by the sounds of things, from a mental perspective as well as a physical perspective, being in that cast. And then how was it getting back to, when you say to fitness, do you mean sort of just generally being healthy as opposed to the fitness you've been at beforehand?
Yeah, even to get back to just like a general standard of fitness was hard, never mind trying to get back into dancing fitness, you know. But yeah, just a lot of personal training sessions and leaving school early to go to the personal training sessions or go to physio appointments, or yeah, it was a lot of work to get back to fitness.
And during that time, did you have it in the back of your head, I want to get back to dancing, or I want to get back to football, or were you thinking, you know what, enough of that now, I see where that's got me?
No, definitely not. It was always in the back. That's kind of what got me through it, you know, was just knowing that finally I'd be able to do sports again and get back to the classes and get back to the training, you know.
Okay.
So no, definitely not. That kept me going.
Okay. So when did you then get back on the dance floor? Well, how many years was it, or how much time was it after you got the diagnosis that you'd broken your back?
It was pretty much a full year.
Right.
So I had the brace on in the 2017, maybe October, and then I got it off the following October.
Okay.
In 2018.
And you get back on the dance floor, how does it feel?
Oh, it's class. It's a great feeling to be back out doing what you love and back with all your friends and finally being able to compete again. Yeah, it's a brilliant feeling.
So you got straight back into it. Tell me now what happened in your dancing career. You went from strength to strength, literally.
Yeah, so I got back and then I actually won my first Ulsters 2018. I had won my first major competition then after getting the brace off. And then in 2021, the first Worlds after COVID, I had won that Worlds in Killarney, and then I've won all the Worlds since that. So I've won 5 times now.
Oh my God, congratulations. That is really some achievement.
Thank you.
And were you still playing football as well, or had you sort of eased off on that?
I had definitely not been playing as much football after the back. I think I played it maybe for another 2 or 3 years after the back brace situation. And then after that, I kind of just called it quits and tried to focus on dancing.
Okay. And I know you've said, Barry, that you sort of kept it quiet, the dancing, that you felt for a while anyway, not now, obviously, you're talking to me about it.
Yeah.
And you've won 5 world championships, so there's no keeping it quiet. But you sort of felt a little bit like, you know, you might have fun made out of you that, you know, boys doing Irish dancing, even though, you know, Lords of the Dance revolutionised all that and Riverdance revolutionised all that. You didn't feel that really.
No, not really. You know, yourself going to an all-boys school, you kind of did get a bit of stick for doing Irish dancing. So I just didn't want to make it any worse by posting about it or talking about it. So no, I didn't really talk about Irish dancing or post about it until I won my first Worlds in 2021.
Yeah, and let them put that in their pipe.
exactly.
When you say you were getting stick, what sort of stick were you getting? Like, what would people say to you?
Oh, just, you know, yourself, like nicknames, or why are you doing dancing whenever you could just be doing football, or, and then especially whenever I picked dancing over the football, that was kind of hard too. But now when you get to a certain age, you kind of just get over it and you don't really care anymore, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then you see other dancers as well, Irish dancers on social media, like on TikTok, there's Corja, I think there's the Gardner Brothers, you know, it's really cool. Like, it's really great to watch. It's amazing. It is though, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. When you get to a certain age, you kind of appreciate it more. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you're very happy to be open about it now, obviously. And do you think you might go down the social media route?
I think so. Yeah. I started posting on TikTok there maybe like the middle of last year. I just thought, you know what, I might as well start posting it because I've never done it before. So yeah, maybe I'll start doing a bit more social media and stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, stay with us, Barry, if you don't mind. We've Kevin Leister as well, also on the line, who's the owner of the Emerald Lakes Academy of Irish Dance. And Kevin, you're very welcome. I'm interested in your thoughts on boys in Irish dancing and whether or not, you know, there's still, you know, a bit of eyebrow raising about it, or, you know, what Barry experienced.
Yeah, just reflecting on what Barry said, of course, it does ring home to myself as well. Now, I grew up through an era of Irish dance where we would have been forced to wear kilts at the time. And I even remember the transition to wearing trousers, which was a huge thing in Irish dance, which kind of made Irish dance a little bit more attractive to boys and to men in particular. And also as a teacher, the footfall of boys through the door is still lacking. But I think that's a lot to do with the competition elements of Irish dance rather than Irish dance itself. I kind of take a little bit of a different look on it. When you, I have my own two boys dancing as well. I have five kids. My two eldest girls dance. My two boys dance. My youngest boy is yet to start dancing. And they're all involved in GAA, whether it's the Gaelic football with the local GAA club in Rochford Bridge or with the LGFA, which one of my daughters is on the development squad for the county in Westmeath. Obviously, that can be demanding as well with training sessions, and trying to fit that in with Irish dance and competition as well can be a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
But
and do you ever find, or do they ever find, they get any sort of negative feedback over it?
Not where we are and not the community we're in, because Irish dance is part of where we are. So, for example, all of the kids there would have been involved in Irish dance at some stage. So there is a huge respect for it. However, I think there's still a difficulty, particularly when boys reach that stage of going into secondary school first year. They kind of face that kind of decision. God, do I keep going with this and maybe put up with different aspects of comments being made or things like that? So I think that's the stage I think they probably, and in my experience, would face more kind of name calling possibly.
Okay.
As well.
I mean, secondary but school is hard anyway, isn't it? Like, yeah. it's hard for so many different reasons, and people don't want to stick out a lot of the time, and they want to find a way to fit in. And you know, you can see how it would happen. And when you say then the competition element is one of the reasons you think boys might, is that because they have to choose between, say, GAA or football or soccer training and dancing?
I think it's 100%. It comes down to commitment, because if you're going full on at Gaelic football or hurling or camogie or ladies Gaelic football and Irish dance competition, it's very hard to fit all of that in, because it takes a lot of athleticism, takes a lot of physical impact to the body through training sessions and also dancing as well. But people who manage their lifestyle very well are able to do both, I do think. And I've seen that in the past as well. But it isn't easy if you need to be at training sessions for football while you need to be at a dance class also. So I think there is challenges there. But in the community where I am in Rochford Bridge in Westmeath, there's a very strong GAA aspect to what we do in Irish dance as well. For example, score, performance Irish dance definitely pulls in more boys than competition Irish dance. And I think also what affects boys and their opinions in Irish dance is having to wear the costumes and diamonds and have to be so clean cut.
Tell me about that if you don't mind, because I'm well long out of the Irish dancing world now. And I don't really remember seeing boys there for the couple of years that I was there. So what, because I know the girls are dressed, you know, very elaborately really. Are the how are the boys dressed?
Generally, the wear nowadays, it's trousers, it's waistcoats. There's a lot of diamonds on them. It can be quite blingy, and some of them don't have to dress that way at all, because generally, it's, you know, your appearance is not marked on. But it's just, I think, the pressures of competition and trying to get to the top, you have to look a certain way and be a certain way.
Yeah.
Where most organisations in Irish dance now are more accepting of the dance rather than the image, as long as they're clean looking on stage.
Well, I mean, that was sort of what, you know, was revolutionary really about Michael Flatley all those years ago on the night that Riverdance launched, was the way he was moving his arms and the flowy shirt and all that. You know, it was just so different from what we were used to, and, you know, it really changed things. I did want to ask you, when you're saying you can do the two together, would you ever worry though about kids overtraining, like what happened to Barry, which I know is an extreme example, but, you know, just getting really, really tired?
Exactly. And again, that can affect our schoolwork, of course. And also, if you think of the build-up of wear and tear, if you know what I mean, with regards to joints and muscles and the physical needs. So nutrition and diet is really important as well. And Irish dance competition, Irish dance at a serious level, and of course, football has gone that way. There's lots of conditioning training. There's lots of protocol around what they can and can't do as well. So I think it comes down to self-management at the end of the day, and you really do have to look after yourself if you do want to sustain a long career in football and dance.
Yeah, and it sounds like people like Barry are very, very disciplined. With Paul on the line as well, Paul Dargan. Paul, are you a dancer yourself?
I am indeed. How are you?
Not too bad. You're very welcome to the programme. Tell me about your own dancing career.
Oh, well, it's a long one, going on a long time and still going. I know Kevin and some of the guys there down through the years. But I suppose I'm in my mid-40s, and we're still performing. There's a few of us together, lads and dads, Irish dancers together. And to be honest with you, we're in our mid-40s, all past world champions, but we're doing what we love, and we love dancing. So for a young boy to be doing it, to us doing it at our age, it gives us so much. Like the amazing people we meet throughout the years in competition and our lifelong friends. And here we are, only recently we performed at the Pints in the Field there, the two Johnnies with the Tim O'Homey Choir, and we were a short tour there in Denmark. And you know what it is? It's an amazing opportunity that we were given as young boys to be able to learn to dance, travel the world, and meet so many good friends and good people. But I'm still in my 40s, and I'm doing what I love with great people.
And did you ever have any hassle around it, Paul? Did you ever come across any of that?
None whatsoever. In a school as a very young boy, I was in school, and at the weekends, after the weekends, I come back in, and my schoolmates, and he said to me, "Where were you at the weekend? What did you do?" I was 13 years of age when I first went off on a tour of America with my sister on the Cultus tour, and the parish and the people and everyone support you. That's a long time ago, and still to this day, there's so much support there for young people in dancing. And you know what? It gives so much. Kevin's a teacher. Everything like that. It just gives kids so many amazing opportunities in life.
Yeah.
And I could write a book on it, to be honest with you. I had nothing but good experiences. And it's so much proven that I am 45, but I'm dancing with people now still that I know for the last 30 years plus.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, it's amazing to have that sort of network as well. Can I ask you, why do you have any theory as to why the number of boys going into it is still shy, as Kevin is saying, you know, that they see that?
I wouldn't have any theory on that, to be honest with you, because I'm very lucky still. My sisters look after the dance school in a home, and there's so many young boys in it, and they come and go, same as girls come and go in the sport, and that is with all types of sports. But you know, I see so many guys that have come from being young little boys into becoming leads in Lord of the Dance, River Dance, and go on to have amazing careers. And to me, to see a child that puts that effort into it to work to achieve their dreams, it's phenomenal. Like Riverdance are doing their workshops there for the last couple of weeks in Boston and Ireland, and to see next generation of my friends' kids doing it and getting that opportunity, that's life changing for them.
Well, I hear you really stole the show at Electric Picnic, Paul, in 2024. Well, that's what I'm told. You know, I'd well believe it, by the way.
No, and you know what it is? It's amazing. And to get an opportunity like that at my age to be performing an Electric Picnic. You know, like my son was there with us last year. He was a year and a half old, and he was in the audience on his mum's shoulders watching me perform. I did the highest 20 something years ago, but to get little opportunities like this to those dreams and to do it with good friends, people, and my wife and my son there. It's the world. It means everything to us all.
Well, stay with this if you don't mind, Paul.
I'd agree with Paul.
You'd agree
100%.
With that as well, would you, Kevin? Okay.
Yeah. With my own kids, the same thing, like memories forever. My own boys, they love the trips away. They love performing. They love being on stage. And it's those memories that keeps them in it. And that's what they love.
And we have Jade Louise Byrne as well on the line. Jade Louise, you're very welcome. Tell me about, you have a dance company with two other people. Is that right?
Hi, how are you? Yeah, so myself and there's actually four of us involved. We have a dance school called The Academy. We're a local school in Ballyfermot in Dublin. And my own son actually dances. I was speaking to somebody earlier on with yourselves, and I said my son started to dance when he was 2 weeks old. He joined our class, so he's been very much part of the academy for a long time. He's 10 now. I suppose he's gone through his grades, and he, like Kevin and the other gentleman was saying there, you know, it's the memories that they make. It's great to have the lads involved. There is a shortfall of them, I will admit that. But I find once they're in, they're very well kind of looked after and celebrated, which I think is very, very important.
Okay,
the organisation that we're part of, CRDM, are fantastic at ensuring that, you know, the boys are well catered for and, as I said, celebrated in the culture of Ireland.
So I think you, am I right in saying you have your own son there and there's only one other boy though at the moment in your dance school, just to sort of give people ideas to sort of the ratios here that we're talking about when it comes to girls and boys. I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. Do you know why that is, or what's your sense of why that is? Or does it make it more difficult then if a boy walks into a hall and pretty much everyone is a girl, that he won't want to come back the next time? Like, it's a sort of chicken and egg type thing.
Yeah, I think, well, I suppose with my own little boy, he kind of has always just been part of the class and has loved the culture. The other little guy that we have, he's 3 and nobody in his family ever danced. He just decided to dance. You know, he wanted to dance one day and he started in our class. We actually have another little fella, he's 6. And the same thing, so he just came along. His mummy said his mother never danced, but he just decided, he saw, I don't know, almost Dream River Dance or Michael Flatley or something, and decided that he wanted to dance. So there's 3 of them, you know, and they're great. They're a big part of the class, I suppose. I'm sure the lads will agree that the boys always get a lot of attention when they dance, and thankfully from our experience, it has been very, very positive.
Okay.
One of my colleagues, my teacher that I have the school with, is male as well, and I think that that's a help, because he's a fantastic example for, you know, for the 3 lads in our school
Well, all this talk about Michael Flatley throughout this conversation, and Barry, as we mentioned, you just won your 5th world title and you are actually off to Feet of Flames with Michael Flatley. You're going to be touring in Taiwan next month, is that right?
Yeah, we leave on the 6th of September off to Taiwan. So, yeah, excited for that.
Okay, well, listen, dance your feet off, Barry, as you've been doing all your life. And thank you so much for joining us to tell us your story. And thanks also to all my other guests on the programme this evening. 51551 if you want to get in touch. The WhatsApp number 087 484 8888.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
You may have heard me speaking earlier in the week about divorce and separation, and I was talking about how I know so many people actually personally who are going through it, and also anecdotally from other people, and just all the difficulties that people encounter that I feel we don't really talk about. Like, you know, what do you do after a divorce? Where do you live? The cost of it can be so expensive for both sides. How it affects your personal life. Like, do friends pick sides? What does that mean for you? And just the length of time that it can take, where you're just left in limbo for all that time trying to get it sorted. So lots of you got in touch after I mentioned that with your own stories about it. And this is just a flavour of some of the issues that people are raising with us, voiced up by some of the Liveline team.
There needs to be more education around divorce. This is essentially a business deal. It comes down to the separation of assets. All the years, the emotion ends in a courtroom. It is so daunting. I feel there is not enough support for people going through divorce. It was a very long and difficult process. For me, it was made longer due to the court waiting times. I had a solicitor and a barrister, so it cost me over 20,000. Divorce is the last thing you want. It should be made easier.
When my marriage ended, so did many of my mutual couple friendships. The loss of my marriage was one thing, but that was another blow I hadn't considered. Sides were taken. I suppose that is inevitable, but it was an additional hurt in an already very difficult time.
I would like to see changes made to how the divorce process is handled legally. I feel it allows an abusive partner to continue their abuse by delaying the process and dragging their feet. The to-ing and fro-ing between our solicitors was motivated by one party and prolonged the entire process.
If mediation works for a couple, that is wonderful. But it is expensive. Going to court was so difficult and I was surprised by how emotional it was. My advice is to make sure you have someone to support you there on the day.
Well, that is some of the people who got in touch with Liveline, and I'm really interested to hear more of your stories on this. If you want to email us, you can get in contact at liveline@rte.ie, or if you want to talk to one of the team, 0818 715 815, you can text us on 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Can you believe we are approaching the 30th anniversary of Braveheart? Oh, God, if anybody wants to feel old, there you go. That's what's going to make you feel old. And it was so huge for Ireland, wasn't it, at the time? Because so much of the movie was filmed here in Ireland. And so many people got involved as extras and as costume designers and it was all of that. So if you were one of those people, you can text us to 51551. We've got Kelvin Feeney on the line. Kelvin, what was your big part in getting Braveheart onto the screen? Important part, Kelvin.
Well, it was just, I was very lucky at the time to be in college and studying fashion. And a bit like your last story about kids doing dancing, there wasn't really many guys in college in NCAD doing fashion. Mm. And so when Braveheart came to Ireland, they couldn't find any male dressers to work in the costume department. There's only one guy, Gabriel O'Brien, who has been in it for years. So there was nobody else. So at the time, supervisor Simon Murray, who was an English guy, got in touch with the college and just asked, was there any guys working in the costume or fashion side of things? So luckily, me and my friend Adam Stewart at the time were like, yeah, we're here, we'll go work on it. So it was just really quite lucky. I had just won a competition at the time, the Smirnoff Young Designer Award. So they saw my name and through that, phoned the college and we got asked to go down and work in the Curragh for the whole summer. It was amazing.
Amazing. So what exactly did you have to do then? What was your job?
Well, we did a bit of everything. Like we go down with like huge trucks would turn up full of hired costumes from Angels of Birmingham in England. And we'd unpack tons of boxes, then empty the boxes, itemize everything, then set up workrooms to display everything so that when the extras come in, they could come in, get their clothes, get their accessories, get dressed and then leave. And then myself and Adam and another guy, Paul Colford from Scotland, worked right beside the designer then, whose name was Charles Node, and he was the designer from The Life of Brian.
Oh, wow.
He actually had a part in The Life of Brian as well. He had some little 2 seconds in The Life of Brian. So it was quite amazing for us. We were just really kids. We were like 22, working with this very funny man, you know, learning all about breakdown and continuity and just how it works as a scene on the film and the whole preparation of getting people in for costume fittings and then making them their clothes and walls and stuff like that.
So I know what continuity is, obviously, so that someone looks the same in a scene as they do in the next scene, unless they're supposed to look different.
Yes.
What's breakdown?
Breakdown is, so it, like that, you may have a scene where as the person wears the costume gradually more and more, it gets broken or distressed or something might get spilled or, you know, if in the scene they get shot, you need to make sure the blood stays there for the rest of the scene. You also need to make sure it's gone if there's a flashback.
Okay.
So we'd have degrees of breakdown. Say an elbow rubbing on a table, you'd have to make sure that maybe the elbow wears through eventually. So in film, you have to keep an eye on all that. So stuff like that. And then you might have clothes that just need to be wrecked. We had like so many boots that would arrive that were brand new from a place in Italy. And we'd get cement mixers and put rocks in them. And you'd throw all the boots in and they'd be running all day just breaking those boots down to make them look old.
Yeah. That is amazing.
Yeah.
Because, of course, that makes sense.
Sometimes you'll get a blowtorch. You'll blowtorch bits of fabric to burn holes into them. You'll use oils and Vaseline and staining all around the neck, around the sleeves, where they might rub their hands. So it really opened up our brains. Like, wow, like there's so much potential here.
Oh, I'm sure it did. Like, what a learning experience. Yeah, I can't imagine the fun. Can you describe what was the atmosphere like then with everyone around?
I mean, it was huge because it was such a huge thing. So, like, when you're all set up, you'd have extras coming in sometimes at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. And you'd have, like, you know, bundles of them coming in. But there'd be 1,000 in the next few hours coming through. And you'd just be high energy, everyone full of and kind of an adrenaline. Got to get the people dressed, got to get them out, got to get them fed, got to get them to set with the ADs and everybody bussing them and involved. And then when they're on set, you need to make sure that they keep their costume as they should be and they don't have, back then, you wouldn't really have worried about phones and carry on like that. Mm. But you'd have people wearing sunglasses and glasses or newspapers, you know, So you have to keep an eye on that. But like at the time, we didn't, although it was a massive thing, you were like, this is just amazing. You didn't know how super it was going to be, the film, in a sense. I mean, you got a sense that it was pretty important because Mel Gibson was there.
Yeah.
And he was acting and directing. So you'd see him behind the camera and then you'd see him in front of the camera, you know. It's quite wild.
Yeah,
it
sounds
an amazing experience.
And just for people, just to remind people like how big this ended up being, it got 10 Oscar nominations in 1996 and went on to win 5 Oscars, Best Cinematography, Best Director, Best Effects. There you go. Best Effects, Kelvin.
Yeah.
Best Makeup, Kelvin. Yeah. Best Picture. So all of you working together, I suppose, to deliver that. And when you say then you're checking the costumes when you're on set, like these scenes were huge, as you say, with hundreds
huge.
Of people at least. So where were you? Like
we were hiding in bushes. You'd be like, if there was a big massive scene, you'd have to run and jump in behind the bush and hide there and wait while they shoot, which happens a lot in film. And then when they cut, you'll go back out and double check your bunch of people and make sure they're okay. And then with the main cast, you'd have main cast costumers who'd be looking after their people. They'd be doing exactly the same. When the AD shout for checks, you'll go in, do your check, make sure everything's okay, make sure something like, you know, if a kilt was one way that it hasn't skewed, you know, or if it has moved and the action, you go in and set it straight again.
How did you keep track? How did you keep track of whose kilt was supposed to be?
Back then you'd have your people to look after, but you used to use, back then was Polaroid cameras, so you'd be taking tons of Polaroid pictures.
Okay.
So, and you just make sure everything's okay so that the next day people could look at the Polaroid pictures and go, well, this actor, his kilt was this way, or neck handkerchief was one way, or the sleeve was this way, or this changed the course. I mean, that happens on every film, you know.
Yeah, okay. And but how like, long would you have to hide in a bush? You know, would you be there for a couple of minutes, or would
it could be half an hour, because sometimes they'll do a scene, you'd have all these extras, you know, because there's an actor in the Irish Mirror today about it as well. I talked about how it was the scene where the Mel Gibson going, hold, everyone had to hold that famous scene.
Yeah,
these thousands of extras, and then when they all run, you'd be hiding waiting for the scene to end. And then when they'd say cut, sometimes they'll say go again. So you'd have to jump out for 2 seconds, make sure everyone's in the right place, and then hide again. So sometimes you could be stuck there for half an hour, which was great, because you'd just be having a chat with your mate then.
Having a chat, listening to like this Oscar-winning film, this amazing scene, iconic movie scene done in the background.
But I mean, as I say, you're like, you're just sitting there, you're psyched. It's just mad. It's like, because film work back then, especially, it's like a big carnival. You know, it's a bit like a circus.
Okay.
And everybody gets to know everybody, and everyone has great fun with each other. You know, it's a real fun community event, you know?
Well, and speaking of community, we have a couple of other people on the line who are also involved. I don't know if any of you ever met each other. You might not know yourselves at this stage, but Simon Roach is with us. Simon, what was your role?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't have the full summer like Kelvin did, even though like I was living out in Leixlip in college, and I wanted to get a summer job on the film because I knew, sure, I was calling out every day to the art department, which I think was in Lucan, and there was no chance. So I ended up working in a kitchen in Fitzers in Dublin for the whole summer. And on the very end of summer, I got a call saying, I was in Equity. I had an Equity card. And they said, do you still have the long hair and a beard? And I was like, I do. They're like, don't cut it. Come in to us tomorrow. And I ended up, because I had the hair and the beard, I got a special extra role, which was in not the big scenes now out in the Curra, but I was in, the first scene was Trim, where there was a big wedding scene in Trim Castle, and I was kind of standing, but I was a knight, so I had chainmail, I had a lovely kind of smock thing on, and whereas other lads who had their hair cut had to wear chainmail hoods, I just had my hair out and they curled it. So I had this curly mop and a big beard, and then from Trim Castle on the first day, we were out in Ardmore, and ended up in a kind of really nice scene with the king, where he's going in his kind of, he's in his castle and he's got like 9 or so knights behind him. And I was one of the knights. Yeah. So it was a really lovely, you know, and yeah, so Patrick McGowan, who was that, the king, King Edward I of England, I think. And, you know, he was in our scene, and I, like, there's a scene where he stops and I'm right behind him, slightly out of focus. So yeah, that was I was real up close to that. I got very lucky.
Do you watch it every Christmas?
I don't. Every now and again, I forget that I haven't seen it in a while.
Already,
but I'm kind of narcissistic. I just go and watch my bit.
Oh, yeah, of course. And did you have the long hair and the beard? Had you sort of grown that out especially, or had you kept it especially?
No, that was college. Oh, that was college style. Yeah, that was all it was. Yeah.
Okay. Simon, stay with us. Sorry, actually, before I go on to Shane, Simon, what was the pay like? Was it good? Because I know a couple of people who...
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I worked in the kitchen for the whole summer, 3 months.
Yeah.
And at the end, I did 4 days on Braveheart. And I ended up with the same amount of money for the 4 days in Braveheart than 3 months in the kitchen.
Really?
And I back then there was a sort of, they didn't stop tax before. They kind of were like, yeah, you look after your own tax, whatever, you know, and you just got the money. Cash, I think. I'm not even sure. It's probably bundled to 50s.
No, Simon, I'm going to save you from yourself here and say, I'm sure you paid all the tax that was due.
I think the statute of limitations is over on that now. I hope it is.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did. All your papers are in order.
Oh, my current papers are definitely in order. I think I got just under 400 quid for 4 days. So that was like £400. That was a massive amount in the mid-90s.
Yeah, it really was. Shane is there. Shane, what? Shane Wallace. Well, I know how you got the part anyway, Shane. Or did you have a part with a name like that? What was your role?
We were one of the 1,600 of disciplined extras, and I think there's a Guinness Book of Records there for the most bare bottoms on the screen, bearing the behinds to English. So that's a bit of a record.
So you were one of a number of extras then, or of the 1,500 extras. How did you get the job, or how did you get involved?
I was with the Reserve Defence Force at the time, the FCA, and we were doing our camp in Castlebar. And then after the camp, they invited us to ask us if we'd be interested in working on the film for a few weeks. Of course, we said, oh, what's the film? What have we to do? So they sent us on then from Castlebar to the Corrib, which our corporal at the time, Benny Barber, put us in the position where we were able to spend a few wonderful weeks in the Corrib.
And what did you have to do? Were you sort of like, Simon was a special extra, we've been told he was in his knight's outfit. What was your job? Like, were you a warrior? Did you have any fight scenes?
Well, there wasn't a lot of different scenes. So between, there was different days, there were shooting different angles. So some days you'd be dressed up as English soldiers, so they were getting the white shots. And the other days you'd be dressed up as Scottish soldiers for the white shots there. And then other days you would be training with another colleague. So you would have somebody from the English side and we would train, we'd have a sparring session. So when they would do the battle scenes then, that you would go on, you'd be charging, and then you would do your routine with your sparring partner until such times as they said cut. But
okay.
That was a good experience. So with you did a number of scenes. We were involved with scenes with the Battle of Stirling and the Curragh, plus in the Battle of Falkirk, which was shot out in Ballymore Eustace. So that was a good experience. And as I say, we had to get up early in the morning, go to wardrobe, get onto the set. It was a warm summer that morning, so we had to get a lot of the sunblock on. And to get us ruffled up a bit, we had to put peat moss on ourselves, rub all the dirt into ourselves to make ourselves look a bit rugged looking.
Oh, really?
It was.
And then put on your cement mixer boots that Kelvin had prepared specially for you. For the fight...
The special boots, and then of course the wigs and all the other different material that you had to wear, plus the kilts as well. So
yeah, so it's not too. For the fight scenes, Shane, did you have to practice those fight scenes like with your sparring partner or whatever, you know, to figure out so nobody gets hurt, I suppose, and so it looks realistic?
Yes, well, that was the reason why you put your partner and you had sparring sessions. But although some of the guys actually took it very seriously when they were doing the filming, so you would have got a few slaps here and there.
Really?
Okay. A lot of them was taking it very serious, but nothing too serious. But you would have got a slap in the wrists or a dig in the ribs very easy. But the director was shouting cut a few times.
Okay. Oh, really? Yeah, okay. Fun fact for anybody who's interested, actually, it was the fact that there was a good availability of members of the Defence Forces like yourself, Shane, and that was one of the things that actually made Mel Gibson come to Ireland, that you were available as extras. That and the tax incentives, apparently, that were here under the Minister for Arts, who, believe it or not, at the time was Michael D. Higgins in 1994. I want to go back to yourself, Simon, because I know this, like, I know you say you don't watch the movie that often, but it does affect your life, doesn't it? Sometimes you were able to get through security in San Francisco because of it.
Yeah, so I got stopped. I think whatever happened, my bag was last off a plane. Like, that was like at least 10 years after the movie. And I was really tired, had to get to my hotel or whatever. And the customs guy, no, stop. You know, he obviously had his quota to reach. So he unzips the suitcase, and it was a big suitcase. I was there for like 2 or 3 weeks. And he starts looking at it and he goes, oh, you're from Ireland. My favourite movie was Film There. And I was like, oh, what one was that? And he says, Braveheart. And I went, I was in it. And he just immediately stops, like, taking out me, stuff out of the suitcase. And he's like, what were you in? And I described the scene. I was in the castle and the king. And he was like, I'm going to go home and watch that tonight. And I was like, yeah, I'm in it, just behind the king on the right when he stops and, like, says that line. And he just zips up my suitcase and was like, have a great time in San Francisco.
Hey!
So I don't know how long I would have been there otherwise, but like, straight through, no problem.
Okay, well, look, I think that's a good note to leave it in. Thank you all so much for joining us with your stories. That's Simon Roach and Kelvin Feeney and Shane Wallace. And if you want to get in touch with their stories about being in Braveheart or indeed anything else, you can text us 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
You may have heard our discussion a little earlier on with Barry Teague, who won the Irish Dancing World Championship 5 times. But when he was younger, when he was 14, he broke 2 vertebrae in his back because of the stresses of overtraining. Well, we're joined now by consultant orthopaedic surgeon Patrick Carton. And Patrick, obviously, Barry's situation was very extreme. You know, he was going to football and dancing pretty much every day, and he's putting an awful lot of stress in his body. But as part of that conversation, you know, we were talking about how much kids are doing and how they can get very tired. And I do wonder, are parents and teens aware of the dangers of overtraining, or what are the dangers of overtraining maybe?
Good afternoon. There's no doubt that when you're playing sports, especially competitive and contact sports in particular, there's always that risk of having an injury, both on the field but also with heavy nights training, maybe 4 nights training a week, competitions a weekend. Many players are involved in more than one sport at the one time. Often when the GA finishes, they maybe play soccer during the break. So it's a continuous feed of high activity through the joints and through the body. And that will take its toll over many years, especially when a lot of the intensity increases in their early teenage years, when a lot of the players are going through growth spurts and musculoskeletal development. It's the time the body needs to be looked after. So certainly there are risks with overtraining. There are risks with just being involved in sports. But you've got to weigh that up then with the very positive aspects of sport and being involved with sports teams as well.
I will note a personal interest that I have in this, because I have 2 boys, and my older boy in particular, you know, he's a very hectic schedule really, because he does GAA, he does soccer, he does swimming, he does tennis. And you know, I notice by Thursday he looks sort of tired, because he's something on every night, and you know, he's going, and some days he's 2 things on, and he's going, but he doesn't really want to give any of it up. But it's trying to balance that then, isn't it? I'm particularly interested that then as he gets older, you're saying during teenagers, because you're growing, you're sort of more at risk potentially. Is that right?
You are, because generally the sports and the training takes an increase in intensity around that age, and you're also competing with players of lots of different sizes. People grow at different rates.
Yeah.
So within certain age groups, you'll have larger players versus smaller players, and that can have a toll in contact sports. But it's the ongoing training and the type of training that's sometimes being put forward can sometimes be improved. I mean, there's a very clear emphasis on muscle strengthening and doing lots of squats and lunges and various things with a lot of weights. And doing that too young will have a negative impact on the shape of the hip and how the hip grows. Obviously, in my practice, I'm a hip surgeon mainly, so we see a lot of athletes with ongoing hip problems on a weekly basis. And a lot of it can be avoided if it's screened for, if it's picked up early. And many athletes feel some of the early symptoms, such as post-activity stiffness in around the hips and groin and hamstrings. It's quite a normal part of life, but for many it's not. It tends to get slowly worse over time. And the physiotherapist and the sports doctors, being aware of this at an early stage, it can be picked up, it can be managed with better types of training programs, and eventually then hopefully they would avoid surgery.
Okay, so that is so interesting. Yeah, because most of the people that I know who run soccer and GAA, you know, they're volunteers, they're parents, and they may have been involved in sports themselves, but they're not, you know, trained coaches or anything like that. They're giving up their own personal time, and we're all very grateful when they do that, I think, around the country. But like, how do you make sure then that people who are running these training sessions know what not to do?
I think it's important to have many of these trainers who, you know, do a fantastic job, and, and I think that an organisation like the GAA depends heavily on volunteers, and that's great. And so the but to have them have the right access to the educational training that they need. Certainly from our clinic, we constantly try and promote the safety of and good training methods, and we are engaging with physiotherapists and doctors across the country. I have done for many years to try and promote that. But even then, you're only touching the surface, really. You know, so it's a big organisation at many levels, and it's not just the GA. It's, you know, football, rugby. It's all very much the same. Any even camogie. Other types of sports, we talked earlier about Irish dancing and ballet. I mean, they have their own type of problems. Any sport that you want to excel at requires hundreds of hours of training, and it will have its toll. And that's just a natural progression of strain on the joint over many years. But again, there are good ways of managing that. And I think it's picking up everybody. As you grow up, many people will have different types of shape to the hip joints, shape to the knee joint, and some are more, they get away with it a bit longer. Others, we see many young guys come in the clinic, whether 14, 15, 16, struggling with problems in their hips, and then they have hips that have developed a little bit less well for their particular sports. You know, so there's a conflict between the sport and how the hip has developed, and that should be picked up fairly early.
That's good. It's really good to get the message out there so people can be aware of it for sure. Because as you say, I think some people might just think that's all part of life, and it doesn't necessarily have to be. That's Patrick Carton there, who's an orthopaedic surgeon.